Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show.
Well, hello and happy hump night from somewhere in middle America. I hope you guys all had a great 4th of July. I am really happy that it's over between me and the dogs and the legality of neighborhood fireworks that I do so wish they would change. I get grumpy. After days from, 11 in the morning until midnight, that people were able to use fireworks for days, and the dogs were nervous. I was nervous. Then I was grumpy, but that sounds bad. That part I didn't like. The getting together with the family, and we got a nice break from the 100 plus heat index, and had a beautiful Sunday and Monday, and that was great. Got a chance to get in the convertible and go on a little road trip and take some pictures, and I was very grateful for that, because starting tomorrow we're going back to summer, and I guess it's time, right? July? In any case, hope you guys had a good long weekend and that your week has started off well. For those of you who are new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a we recovery program because it is in the we that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers. And for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. Again, I'm your host, Kim Justice, and my guest tonight I've really been looking forward to. For those of you who read one of the many posts over social media, you know that Jody Lyons is an elder care expert who helps older adults and those with special needs find the care they need throughout the country. An ardent patient advocate, Ms. Lyons helps people navigate the complicated, often convoluted system, identify what they need, and learn how to create an action plan. With more than 20 years' experience in the nonprofit healthcare arena, she has been a leader in national and international organizations representing healthcare and long-term care service providers. She was on the executive committee of the Alzheimer's Association, National Capital Area, and an Alzheimer's Association ambassador to Capitol Hill. Lyons is a writer for and industry advisor to Telemedicine Magazine. She also wrote the award-winning book The Smart Person's Guide to Elder Care, to empower and educate consumers to make sense of a complex system and to highlight some of the humor that can be found even in the most challenging times as we grow older. Jody also co-authored the book Brain Health, As You Age, A Practical Guide to Maintenance and Prevention. And you can see more, both of these books are found on Amazon, but the website, which is in the program notes, and I'll be giving you a few times throughout the show, is Brain Health As You Age, brainhealthasyouage.com. And one of the reasons, aside from what I just read to you, that I wanted to have Jody on is that a lot of us in this audience felt like our brain got older as far as not having the same capacity that it had before, maybe processing slower than it did before, maybe the ability to focus and concentrate a little less than we were able to do before our injuries, short-term memory loss. A lot of us, and in my case, I was 35 years old, I felt after my brain injury that my brain had already aged quite a bit. It felt like I was operating in an older person's brain. And face it, we're all going to get older, except for those who unfortunately have a premature death. The rest of us are faced with aging. And many of us brain injury survivors also have parents or a parent, parents that are aging. And that's a complicated enough issue when you're healthy and younger, but when you've suffered brain trauma of any kind and you're dealing with your own capacities or lack thereof and how to improve them, it's very hard to take on that other task of being able to be a caregiver when you're the one who needed a caregiver. Hard to play both ends of that stick at the same time, that's for sure. So for a lot of different reasons, which I'm sure you can see now, I invited Jody to be on the show tonight, and I'm going to bring her on now. Very happy to have her. This is Jody Lyons. Welcome to the show, Jody.
Thanks, Kim. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, now you had a little experience yourself. You know a little bit about what our audience and our demographic faces because of your own personal experience before you got to be an elder care expert and the things we're going to go on and talk about. But I imagine it also gives you your personal experience. I know it does for a lot of us around here, a good deal more insight into these issues when you've experienced parts of them yourself.
Absolutely. So I was an elder care expert, have been for decades, and I made my living helping people find the care they need throughout the country. And I had written a book on care management. It's called The Smart Person's Guide to Elder Care, and I know you alluded to that earlier. So I knew my stuff. What I was not prepared for was what I thought was an asthma attack. And I went to the hospital, and that asthma attack turned into a need for a triple bypass. And following the surgery, I had a stroke. So in 1 minute, I was fine. And in the next minute, I wasn't. Now, we understand I wasn't really fine or I wouldn't have needed a triple bypass. But all of a sudden, I was faced with being, as my friends have put it, on the other side of the bed. I was the person in the bed being the patient. And fortunately, I had phenomenal access to medical care, and incredibly, incredibly supportive friends and family. So I happened to be at the Virginia Hospital Center in Arlington, Virginia, which is now affiliated with the Mayo Clinic, and they were the best of the best. And my two co-authors of the new book, which is Brain Health as You Age, Dr. Simmons and Dr. Mansbach, were not going to let me fail. And so I was lying in bed, completely paralyzed on my right side, and I had my two co-authors keeping everybody in shape. And the other advantage was being on the board of the Alzheimer's Association meant I had access to the best brain doctors in the entire world. And so nobody would let me fail, but I know what it's like to be lying in bed, totally vulnerable, being unable to take care of any of your own bodily functions. And now I'm speaking to you from my new house, where I can walk around with a cane and take care of everything myself. So it is possible. So I totally can sympathize and empathize with the audience.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things, and we'll probably talk about this at some point in the interview, it might be right now, but out of order, but something you said just made me think about it. You know, I talk a lot about we have to be our own best advocate, but, you know, at the point of impact, most of us have no idea what just happened, and we're at our most vulnerable and confused because we've never had this happen before. We were bulletproof before. And, you know, I don't think I had ever heard of an aneurysm before I had mine. And so it's very hard to advocate when you're clueless and at your most vulnerable. So that's definitely an issue. And I see that as, you know, as I've watched my folks aging, even, you know, even to me, it feels like the doctors are 12 when I walk in there now, and I'm starting
and
to feel the effects of. Right, exactly, and that makes. I'm just getting to the point where that crossover has happened. And the doctors aren't older than me now. They're much younger. And that automatically, that makes me feel less secure in a lot of ways. Maybe it should make me feel more secure because they're probably on the cutting edge. But there's a difference between what's in the books and experience, too, especially when it comes to matters of the brain.
Well, exactly. But I will say to you that one of the things I like the most is when somebody's young. I love teaching hospitals, and I love when the senior physicians are teaching the younger physicians. But I think the big issue, and you touched on it, is how are older adults treated in the healthcare system? Are they taken seriously? And I'm sure you've seen new results on, like, women's heart attacks, for example. Women's heart attacks aren't treated the same way men's are, and many women are sent home because they don't present with crushing pain in their left arm, so they must not be having a heart attack. And if you're just because you're older doesn't mean that you don't know what you're talking about, and just because you're a woman doesn't mean that you're not also having a heart attack. And what I always say is, if you are not comfortable with your doctor, you fire them. You can fire a doctor even in a hospital, but you need to be comfortable and know you're being treated well. And, I mean, I was lucky that I was treated as if I were a colleague. And there was one very funny incident in the hospital. So I had just had the stroke, and the nurses are shoving my whole bed to the elevator to push me into the CAT scan. And as we're waiting for the elevator, I say to them, "Can you hear me? Do my words make sense?" because I knew enough to be dangerous. I knew if my right side was paralyzed, my stroke was on the left side of my brain, and it was likely hitting my speech center, and I probably lost my ability to speak. And the two nurses stopped, looked at me, could not help themselves, and laughed and said, "Yes, we can hear you. Yes, your words make sense. Are you running your own neuro exam on yourself?" And I said, "Well, yes, I am." And because I had started, Dr. Mansbach has a great screening tool called the Brief Cognitive Assessment Tool, the BCAT. And I administer that test sometimes. So I was testing myself. Well, you know, I was not with it enough to recognize that by virtue of testing it, that meant I couldn't use it on myself because it was in a different part of the brain. But I absolutely was waiting to see where I knew enough to know where there was a problem. And the hospital team treated me as if I were a colleague. And so I was very lucky. I have seen in other hospitals, I've seen patients ignored or disregarded because they're old. And you should never stand for that.
Well, and something you said too muddies the water a little bit in this new healthcare system. And I didn't realize, because back when I had my issue, your doctor was your doctor. You know, they came, they had appointments in their office in the afternoon, and they did their rounds in the hospital in the morning. Now, when my dad was hospitalized several years back, I was shocked to learn of this new system. I guess under universal health care, the Affordable Health Care Act, that now our doctor stays in his office and sees two or three times as many patients, and we have a hospitalist assigned to us who we likely don't know from a bottle of Vicks when we are admitted to the hospital. And that I found a very interesting dynamic, because all of a sudden you're not connected to your doctor and you're meeting a stranger for the first time while you're an inpatient in the hospital, someone you've never met before, and they're charged with your life and your treatment plan. And that, to me, even feels more vulnerable than we might personally feel because of the state we're in, the cause of why we were admitted in the first place. And then having surprise, this is your hospitalist in charge. You know, that so many things have changed, and to try to maneuver and be your own best advocate in that, in this new system. I think it was always difficult, but things are more complicated now, more chefs in the kitchen, I guess.
There
Which
are
maybe
more
that's
chefs
good.
In the kitchen. Well, in some ways it's good. In some ways the electronic medical records are good. And in other ways they're not good. The personal relationship that people used to have with their physicians is often not there. Sometimes messages don't get translated. One of the things I always say to people is you have to know what medicines you take, and you have to know who's going to help you in case of an emergency. And the other piece is, when I say the who's going to help you in case of an emergency, I mean you need to go to your attorney and your financial advisor. If you're an older adult, you need to go to an elder law attorney. At the very least, you need an estate attorney, and you definitely need a financial advisor to make sure all your ducks are in a row, because if you are not able to advocate for yourself, you need to know that the person who's going to do so has the information they need and the legal authority to do so. So you need to do an advance directive, sometimes known as a living will. You need powers of attorney over health and a durable power of attorney over your finances. You need somebody who knows, and this, you know, in this day and age, this is one of the most important things. Where's the password to your computer? Where's the password to your cell phone? Can somebody get into your bank account to pay your bills? Some people even have so many electronic things, they can't get into the house without a keypad code. Somebody you trust needs to know that, because if you're not able to advocate, nobody can help you. And I had all of my legal documents done, and I've had them done for years. I had them, my parents had them, my sister had them, my doctors had them. They were in a file folder in my house. And when push came to shove and I found out I was having surgery, I was afraid nobody would be able to find anything in the panic of the moment, and had the social worker at the hospital get me the forms and fill out everything again. And then I realized that if, God forbid, anything happened to me, which it did, I guess maybe it was a premonition, nobody would be able to pay my electric bill. What's the password to get in to pay your electric bill? I don't do anything with pieces of paper and writing checks. So I literally sat down with my passwords, and I had two friends with me, and they wrote down. So I'm in the hospital before my surgery, and fortunately before the stroke, with my friends writing down the logins and passwords for the phone bill, the electric bill, the condo fee, and everything else, so that I could relax and be the patient. And there
wow,
was still
those
persist all through the cracks.
Yeah, I was going to say that those are really good points, right? They are a good reason to keep your house in order and have those things taken care of, because, you know, as I always say, none of us get up in the morning expecting the way that that day evolves for us brain injury survivors, be it a stroke, an aneurysm,
exactly,
a TBI, whatever it is. None of us plan
absolutely
on it. And the things that you just mentioned, wow, you know, and time, again, this is another product of times have changed. When you said what you just said, when I was in the hospital, my folks were bringing me my mail and my bills were in the mail, and
mm-hmm,
they were able to get into my house and get my checkbook. But the other thing that it made me want to write down somewhere are my username and password, because with the short-term memory issues that a lot of us here have, when put upon in the hospital like you were before your surgery to remember our usernames and passwords,
exactly,
to be able to help someone else to help us, we wouldn't remember what they were. Even at home, and I'm on Amazon quite a bit, but I forget it just about every time I log in and
well,
have
exactly
to have them send me a new one. Jeez,
so
Louise.
You have to have your passwords with all your legal documents locked away someplace safe and let somebody you trust know where the key is. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's one of the things that I say all the time, and it makes Dr. Simmons and Dr. Mansbach are wonderful, wonderful people. And I know I make them a little crazy when we do presentations, and I say when we're talking about getting older or dementia or cognitive impairment, I say, if you think something might be wrong, if you think it's something immediate like a stroke or a heart attack, of course you call 911. If you think you might just be getting a little forgetful, please go to your attorney and financial advisor first and then go to the doctor, so you don't get caught
mm-hmm
up in the timing of getting a diagnosis and let the other stuff fall by the wayside. And I do always
right
say, if you think there's a problem, call 911. But, you know, you have to decide how much of a problem. But it's not really a joke. I mean, how many people walk around, and I know I've done this for years, and I do sometimes try to blame the stroke, and then I'm corrected and pointed out that that was the wrong lobe of the brain, and I can't really blame the stroke. But walking around looking
oh
for my glasses, and they're on the top of my head.
Yes. Yeah.
Or you walk into the room, and you say, what did I come in here for?
Yes.
And so one of the things we talk about is attentional memory. And we try to determine, is something a problem? or is it normal aging? If it disrupts your regular life, it's a problem and you need to get it looked at. But there are a lot of things about normal aging and a lot of things to your earlier point about the world has changed. So our attentional memory is split so many different times. So you walked into the room to get something, but the phone rang while you're on the way. And so you answered the phone call, and then you noticed that you forgot to put that piece of mail in the recycling bin. So you pick up the piece of mail on the way, and all of a sudden you're holding the phone in one hand and the mail in the other hand, and you walk into the kitchen and you don't know why you're there. It's pay attention.
Yes.
Or driving. I mean, how many times have you driven and you are going from point A to point B, and somebody calls and says, do you want to have dinner together? And you say, okay, and you have a conversation about what you're going to get at the grocery store, and then you drive past the exit for the grocery store.
Yeah.
It's attentional memory. Yeah. Yeah, it's attentional memory. So, you know, one of the things I always talk about is what do we – there are chapters at the end of our book, in the Brain Health as You Age book. One of the chapters at the back of the book is from the other side of the bed. It's the patient's perspective. And what I try to go into there is what's normal, what's not normal, when it's a problem, what do you do about it, and what can you expect? What are reasonable expectations of yourself and of others? And there are some realities, right? I mean, you're not ever going to get somebody to jump every time you have an itch. There, you know, you need somebody to scratch something, and we know how frustrating that is. They're not always going to jump to come help you do that. But there are certain things that you can expect. You can expect caring, compassionate, very good medical care. You are going to find that you have friends and family, some of whom will take care of you and some of whom you need to jettison from your life. And you'll find that there are certain glitches that are just going to be. And then how do you compensate for those glitches? So if you know your short-term memory is going, you write down the passwords and you put them someplace safe and you're consistent on your routine. And you pay attention to things you're doing because it's not really multitasking. You're switching among tasks. And so how do you make it easier on your brain? Do one thing at once.
Yes, and, you know, that's an interesting thing to try to explain to people. I wrote a book back in 2012, and there are two others that are on my bucket list that I would like to write. And I've mentioned it to a couple of people who, anyway, people who haven't had a brain injury, and they're like, well, do it. You know, why don't you do it? And I said, well, you know, I do this weekly radio show, and it's not just the 2 hours I'm on the air. I spend a lot of time networking and talking to people.
Yes.
About shows, you know, and book my shows out a couple of months. And I'm always on the phone or doing research, and I couldn't do the book justice or the show justice, and I would probably lose them both out of fatigue, frustration, you name it. they're both too big of a nut, along with just day-to-day life, remembering to get the groceries, the gas, you know, visit the family, you know, just the normal day-to-day operations. It's challenging enough, you know, and I just said, well, it'll have to be when I retire from radio. I have no plans of that audience in the near future, but, you know, that then I would transition into doing that. And you're absolutely right. Whenever I'm multitasking, I forget all of the examples you gave I felt like a kid, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners did too, felt like a kid with their hand caught in a cookie jar. You just one after another with your examples. It was like, oh my goodness, you know.
So, well, I will tell you, Dr. Mansbach taught me this, and he has a website, Enrich Visits, ENRICHVISITS.com. And he has screenings you can do yourself. He has screenings if you need a virtual visit, so that somebody can do.
Can you give that again?
Sure.
I'm sorry.
Enrich Visits, ENRICHVISITS.com. And
got it. Okay.
One of the things that he has taught me, so the self-assessment of cognition is terrific. People can just go take care of it themselves. Or you can do a virtual visit with one of his trained professionals, and it's a screening, so you don't even need to go to a doctor. But one of the things he taught me was that when you think you're multitasking, your brain is switching among tasks. So, for example, if you're trying to remember two things, right, I'm trying to remember to do something in the kitchen and concentrate on the telephone, your brain is actually trying to remember three things, which is the two things you're trying to remember and the fact that it's trying to remember two things.
Right.
So he has some fun exercises where he shows that it's really task switching, not multitasking. And the first time he did it, and I was in the audience, I stared at him and I went, uh-oh. Now I understand it better, but it was truly frightening. And then, you know, one of the sad facts is that we all lose stuff and we all have too much information coming at us, right? How many times is your TV on or your radio on? You're on the phone and you're trying to do something. All of that input is making your brain switch tasks. And to your point, we get less efficient, and after brain injuries or things like that, we're going to get even less efficient. You have to recognize when you're tired. But
yeah,
there's a difference between is this normal or is it not normal, and so that's actually one of the reasons we wrote the book, was basically we all have friends who have parents with some sort of, you know, Alzheimer's or some other dementia. And I was getting to the age where when I lost my keys, I'd laugh and go, oh, come on, where could I possibly put my keys? And I could retrace my steps. When my friends whose parents had one of the dementias lost their keys, they said, oh, my God, this is it. I'm going to end up just like Mom. And, you know, people need to know what's normal, what's not normal, when they need to worry, when they don't need to worry, and what can you do about it. There are ways to mitigate your risks. There are no cures, but there are things you can do to reduce your risk a little bit. And one of them, of course, is doing exactly what you did, recognizing where there's a problem. And so you're doing the right thing by saying, I can't write a book while I'm doing something else. And of course, people who haven't written books before don't always understand that. Those of us who have said, you're lucky if you can remember to eat and go to the bathroom when you're in the middle of writing a book.
Exactly. Exactly.
And you certainly can't sleep. We know that. So
no.
Right.
Yeah, no, not at all. Well, so let's talk for a minute about dementia. You know, there's people hear the word dementia. They hear the word Alzheimer's. They may know someone that they're related to, or as you said, a friend's family member who might have it. And we know them. A lot of us know them as not being able to remember, forgetfulness. Obviously, there's differences. Within the realm of dementia, are there more varieties, different types of dementia?
Well, I have to tell you, Kim, that was a great, great question. First of all, dementia is an umbrella term. Dementia is not actually a disease. So we use this as more of a generic thing for a cluster of symptoms. And what I always say to people is if they've gone to the doctor and their doctor says you have dementia and doesn't specify what type, I tell them to find another doctor. So I'll give you some examples of different types of dementia. So the first and most common is Alzheimer's disease. There's also an early onset Alzheimer's disease, which affects younger people, vascular dementia, Lewy body dementia, Parkinson's dementia, frontotemporal dementia, which used to be called Pick's disease, and some of the older textbooks still say that, Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome, mixed dementia, and then any of you who read the movie Concussion or read the book, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Now, the reality is that nobody really knows what causes most of the dementias. CTE, the chronic traumatic encephalopathy, we know is from head injuries. Lewy body dementia was in the news recently when Robin Williams passed away. And some of the newer research is showing, so a Lewy body is a protein that has a particular shape that you can actually look at it under a microscope and see that shape. What they're starting to discover now is that Parkinson's disease very often has the presence of Lewy bodies in it. So there's another disease called dementia with Parkinsonism that isn't Alzheimer's and isn't Parkinson's, but has aspects of both. And so basically they all have different characteristics. The one thing we know is that they affect the brain. And there are tests. There are ways to find out what type of dementia you have. The very big, ugly problem is that many of the tests are very expensive, and many insurance companies don't want to pay for a PET scan, for example.
I see. So
if you go to somebody who specializes, so you would go to a neurologist who specializes in brains. And the other thing is that people may want to go look at clinical trials because some of those clinical trials will actually pay for the tests, and then you don't have to pay for them. But, yes, there are multiple kinds of dementia. They have different characteristics, different trajectories. And in my world, as somebody who helps people find the care they need, the different diseases look different and different places can take care of them. So not every memory care unit could take care of the behavioral issues of an early onset Alzheimer's or of a frontotemporal dementia.
I was going to ask you about that because the many of us were injured in a frontal temporal zone, and there may not be a connection, but it's appearing with CTE, and I've had Dr. Amalu and Dr. Dukowski and Kevin Nowinski and a number of these people as guests. And now, of course, with CTE, they're formulating, so many things. There's not a definitive test that will give you a diagnosis. Now, what I've known of CTE most of the time I've been on the radio, 7.5 years, is that they can't tell for sure until a special type of autopsy that's not routinely done is done on the brain in one of about four places around the country to be able to tell if it's CTE. Yet, I noticed in the last year or so that people are being told that they have CTE based on a list of characteristic symptoms that they're putting together. And I feel kind of uncomfortable with that. But when I thought about it, which doesn't mean I'm more comfortable with it, but, you know, for Parkinson's, for fibromyalgia, for a lot of things, there's not a definitive test. It's X amount of symptoms, and if you hit the bar on 10 out of 12 of the symptoms, suddenly you have a diagnosis.
It's a really difficult situation. That there are new scans that have come out within the past couple of years that can see which parts of the brain are functioning and which aren't. One of the most interesting things I've seen is that there's a consideration of Alzheimer's to be diabetes type 3 because they can give you glucose and then do certain scans of your brain and see whether the glucose is going into your brain and whether your brain's using it or not. They've done some phenomenal work with developing biomarkers, but a lot of these things are still in their infancy. And so there are clusters of symptoms. They can, in certain cases, you know, do PET scans, do CAT scans, do MRIs, do functional MRIs, use different dyes. There are now different dyes which bind to different proteins in the brain. So they can actually see whether it's a tau or amyloid plaque. But again, the tests are not for us mere mortals because they're hard to get. So
my guess
is that as they continue to find the biomarkers, they'll be able to find better diagnostic tools and then maybe better ways to treat whatever it is we're trying to treat. But for the CTE, for example, that's a hard one because that's new. And the way it was explained to me is if you take a bottle of soda and drop a ping pong ball in it and you shake the bottle of soda, even if the ping pong ball doesn't break or doesn't actually necessarily hit the side of the bottle, it's actually been disrupted and shaken.
Yes.
So in CTE, and they're discovering that in some cases, for example, you don't have to have your head hit by the IED exploding, but within a certain distance, your brain has gotten shaken. And so now they're just starting to look and see where in the brain something has shaken. Is there atrophy of the brain? Where is there atrophy of the brain? Are there symptoms, et cetera? They just don't have a complete answer for everything yet. But they're getting there, and the science is improving leaps and bounds every year.
Now, what about going back? I detoured on the CTE, but on the front temporal lobe, is there how does that manifest differently than, say, one of the others?
So that is a great question. For people who are not sure where the frontal lobe is, smack yourself in the forehead and go, oh, no. Like when you can't believe the stupidity of the person in front of you, the part of your, when you're in front of your head with your hand, that's the frontal lobe. And that's considered the gatekeeper. And the way it's been explained to me is when you're driving down the street and the driver in front of you is not paying attention and slows down at a green light, the part of your brain that keeps you from accelerating through him, smashing him and knocking him off the road because he's in your way, is your frontal lobe. And so that is your gatekeeper. And there are very often behavioral issues if your frontal lobe is damaged. So there can be extra aggression. There can be overacting sexually. There can be other behavioral issues. They can very often, during some of the scans, see whether the frontal lobe has been damaged. They can see whether it's shrunk at all. One of the things that happens is those people have behaviors. So there are certain commonly expected behaviors called BPSD, behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia. And those are things that we can expect to happen. And there are ways that you can non-pharmacologically redirect people to deal with those behaviors. So wandering, things like that. Getting aggressive when you're trying to bait somebody. There are ways to handle that person differently. Then, when all else fails, there are medications that you can use. With the frontal lobe, that tends to hit people who are younger and stronger. And that tends to be a lot harder for a lot of facilities and caregivers to handle. So now picture somebody who's got a 50-year-old body with damage to the frontal lobe, so their gatekeeper's not working, and they're big and strong, and they could take out three caregivers in one swipe of their arm. That becomes much more difficult to take care of. There are companies throughout the country and specialized places that are very, very good at handling those behaviors. And then there are others that simply aren't, and they find out the hard way that they can't.
Right.
So it's and again, I know we talked about enriched visits a little bit. One of the things I found most fascinating about Dr. Mansbach's screening tools is that you can tell whether executive functioning or judgment is off. So somebody could have a little glitch in their short-term memory, but their executive functioning and judgment is way off. And then we know that we need to plan differently. So we don't have to wait until somebody, and I'm sure your audience hears this all the time, okay, they have somebody like a parent or a sibling or a spouse goes into an assisted living that says they can handle memory care, and then their family member becomes violent, usually around bathing or getting undressed or something like that. And then the family member is told, congratulations, you need a private duty aide 24/7 if you want us to keep your family member here.
Right.
And that's because that behavior poses a danger to themselves or others.
Right. I was going to say, and that goes back to what you said in the beginning about depending, when we talked about that and the different types that that dementia is an umbrella, describing a lot of different types of diseases that not just any assisted care. I mean, that's, I think, the way that a lot of us have been trained to think, you know, you've got independent living, and then you've got assisted care, and then you go to skilled care, and it's a nursing home situation. And that's not necessarily going to be the case, depending on what type of dementia a person would have. I could see where that would be very problematic.
Yes, and Dr. Simmons is a house call doctor, so he sees dementia in the home all the time. And one of the hardest things is when you have one of the dementias that strikes people younger, is usually that person is home with a spouse and kids. And what does it look like in the home, and how long is it safe to keep the person in the home, and what kind of support systems do you need? And it really is very important to know exactly what it is you're dealing with. And it's the same sort of thing when you're talking about stroke. Where was the stroke? What does it affect? And what can you expect from it? Not all strokes are the same. You know, they say if you've seen one stroke, you've seen one stroke. And if you've seen one person with Alzheimer's, you've seen one person with Alzheimer's. There are some generalizations we can make, but the reality is, what kind of care does a person need now? What are they likely to need in the future? And how do you ensure that the person who says they're going to be able to take care of them can?
Exactly. Interesting. Now, in your work, have you seen, or has this even come up, that like it did with CTE and some of these other dementias, that trauma to the brain, repeated trauma to the brain, particularly can lead to any of these forms of dementia. Have you seen studies to support that, or that's not part of what you've been working on?
Well, actually, we have seen studies, and it's hard to answer this question to this audience, and particularly to myself, you know, having had a stroke and knowing the vascular dementia increased risk that I have. But
right.
When you're looking at regular dementia, worldwide they say that there are 7.7 to 9.9 million new cases of dementia, basically assuming that there's one new case every 4.1 seconds. Okay.
Wow.
In the U.S., there's 5.7 million people living with dementia, and Alzheimer's is about 60 to 70% of those cases. But then you throw in traumatic brain injury on top of that. And when you look at traumatic brain injuries, they say that there are just in the U.S., 1.7 million people sustaining a TBI annually. Of those 1.7 million, 275,000 require hospitalization, 52,000 die. And then you look at what is the environmental risk factor for dementia based on traumatic brain injury, right? So traumatic brain injury is considered to be one of the best established risk factors for dementia. And so there was a study recently. It was a meta-analysis, so this was somebody reading the data from 15 other case studies, big controlled studies, sorry. And those stats say that somebody who had a head injury sufficient enough to lose consciousness meant that they were at a 50% increased risk of dementia compared with others. So the average risk of dementia is about 11% without a family history. It's about 11% of people ages 60 to 85, 11% of those people are going to get dementia by the age of 85. If you've had a head injury sufficient enough to result in a loss of consciousness, your risk would be approximately 50% higher.
Hmm.
And then if there are multiple TBIs, that risk increases more, but they're not sure exactly how much.
Yeah, we probably don't need to know. I just say that you do have to have the sense of humor about it. But, you know, the earlier studies before that we talk about here is that people who have had a TBI are more likely to have subsequent TBIs than someone who's never had one before. So then going a step further to what you said, would make sense. But one of the reasons that I brought that up, I had it after those other guests that I mentioned to you, and the reason I threw it to you to ask the question is not long ago I had a dissenting view on from a former NFL football player, and he doesn't buy, you know, and he worked with a couple doctors. But he thinks the neuroplasticity element takes care of it. And this is somebody who, what took him out of being an NFL player was a couple of concussions, one which did knock him out, stopped his heart, as a matter of fact. And he had to be resuscitated. Now, he wrote a book, and I had him on, and it was, I told him he was going to have to be polite based on the conversation we had before the show, and I didn't want to do it, you know, but and he was, but I still was left slack-jawed, I guess, listening to what he and whatever couple doctors he was working with, how they came up with what they came up with, because you know, and he came right out and said, this is not my opinion at all, but his opinion was that the work that that they do at BU were flawed science, flawed studies, and just not true. He completely kissed them off and gave a, you know, a couple political monetary reasons why, which I also didn't agree with. But in any case, most of us in this community and that are here at the network, we know these things to be true because we have had a subsequent brain injury after. Now, not like the stroke, not like the aneurysm, but, you know, and bear with me a minute, listeners, I know you've heard this before, but 3 years ago, and the whole thing on concussion has changed. I say it's not your grandma's concussion anymore, or not your mom's concussion anymore, really, depending on how old you are. It is a TBI, considered a TBI now, and you don't have to be knocked out for it to be considered a concussion, and there's whiplash concussion. And falling is the number one cause of TBI. And, gee, just a normal day. I was going out on the back deck to look at the paper, and I had a cup of coffee and my reading glasses and the newspaper and whatever. My hands were full. And I still don't know what happened, if I tripped on the threshold of the doorway or what happened. But suddenly I was flying through the air, and all I could think of in that split second is, don't hit your head, for fear of, you know, what happened before. So when I landed, I was real lucky it didn't break, but I had one leg bent under my butt and kind of fell back, and then my arms were locked really straight, hard out in front of me. And when I rocked back, I banged forward on the butts of my hands really hard, and my neck snapped badly. And what I try to tell people, and what I was trying to talk to that guest a little bit about, is that, and this is another part about that advocating deal, is that when I had my aneurysm, I knew nothing about brains, had never met another brain injury survivor or a doctor who knew anything about it for 17 years after I had my injury. And I've learned, I say all the time, I've learned more in the last 7.5 years here from our audience and guests like yourself than I knew in almost 2 decades prior. But, you know, I had been doing shows and been a weekly host for quite a while when I had this fall. And it didn't occur to me, I mean, several times a week I was getting really bad headaches and going and, like a robot, going to the Advil cupboard and taking 2 or 3 Advil, and then going in and laying in my darkened, cool, with no noise room and trying to breathe through the headache and help the Advil work. And, you know, I was doing that for a couple months, almost 3 months. And one day, this is what was scary to me, is it didn't occur to me, and this is after I knew better, it didn't occur to me that that wasn't normal. And what finally got me to that point was, within 2 or 3 days of each other, both my mom and my husband said, boy, it seems like you're sure having a lot of headaches lately. And then the light bulb went on 3 months later, that I hadn't, you know, that a blow to the head often puts you not in your right mind to be thinking and processing properly. And that makes it even more difficult. Now, once I got that cue from both of them in a proximity close enough to each other that I didn't forget, and that light bulb went off, I went and got looked at, and they told me that I had post-concussion syndrome. And like with so many of the other things that people go through that get TBIs around here, after that, there's really, okay, good luck. See you later.
Right.
Not a lot of answers or treatment, you know, an empty diagnosis. You've still got the symptoms, and a lot of those you learn how to deal with from people like you, books like yours, our own things. We come up with our own compensatory strategies. Oftentimes they're not learned from any kind of therapy, because if we can walk and talk and have the conversation that says, this is what happened to me, this is what I did, well, okay, that means you have post-concussion syndrome, and, you know, you did become aware of it, and so good luck, you know, and kind of send you down the road. And what I found for me is that exacerbated some of the residuals that I had way back from 1995, but it also gave me some new stuff, like a bad neck and going down into the spine. And I remember a guest who came on that said, the brain doesn't end in the head, you know, and
exactly.
I thought, boy, that's for sure. That's for sure, because it's seed one through three.
Oh, absolutely.
Go ahead.
I'm so sorry you had to go through it. I'm sorry you had to go through it. And it is absolutely, look what your brain is attached to. It's attached to your spinal cord, and they talk to each other.
Yeah.
The nerves and the neurons talk to each other. But you've raised an incredibly important point there. Number one, if you are a family member or a friend, and you see something wrong with a friend of yours, and they don't seem to be aware of it, and it seems to be something brain-related, say something to them. Be kind about it, but if you're looking at somebody who's had a stroke, like in the middle of having a stroke, don't sit there and look at them. Call 911. And if somebody is having, if you know that somebody fell and they're having headaches, you say, my goodness, you're having a lot of headaches. Did you call your doctor? Because sometimes the brain isn't processing, I'm having a lot of headaches. Maybe I should call my doctor or go to the hospital.
Well, and do know, too, in that point is that, you know, nobody thought of it because I didn't hit my head. So don't think it's not an issue. You know, if you say, did you happen to hit your head lately or, you know, something like that. And the person says, well, no, you know, I didn't hit my head. In fact, I remember, you know, after I fell in that neck, you know, just doing a quick assessment. No, I didn't hit my head. Oh, thank God. No, my leg isn't broken. Oh, thank God. You know, and I gave myself an okay, you know, on the spot at that deal. And I had heard of coup contra coup and whiplash concussion and all of that, and it didn't even occur to me. and so I definitely piggyback what you said, is that if it weren't for, you know, people close to me noticing and saying something, and then hopefully, audience, you've been listening enough that that light bulb would go on for you. To not argue the point, but listen to what the person has to say. It doesn't mean you've been knocked out or that you necessarily hit your head, but something is seemingly simple sounding is I fell really hard, you know, which snapped my neck back and forth. You know, falls are the number one cause of traumatic brain injury. So do, if you're, just like Jody said, if you notice in a friend or a loved one, uncharacteristic behavior, brain related, as you said, you might ask them if anything has happened, you know, anything different has happened, because you seem a little off, you know, which
well,
we do
exactly.
Sometimes if a friend seems sad or something like that, you know, somebody we know will say, what's going on with you? You're not seeming quite like yourself, or I'm noticing
right.
this like they did. You
well,
seem like you're
exactly,
having
exactly. You're
yeah.
having a tough time today. You seem tired. Is everything okay? And it's interesting because we had started talking about different types of dementia, and the other side of the coin is something called delirium, which is sometimes called reversible dementia, but it is something's different. Something was the same before, and now something is different. And so, to your point, there was a fall. What changed? There was a fall. Sometimes there are people who act like they have Alzheimer's disease, short-term memory loss, or they have poor judgment, or like they act like one of the other dementias, they're getting violent, the mood has changed, etc. And it's something called delirium. And that can be caused by crazy things. It could be caused by medication, a urinary tract infection, dehydration, sodium levels being off. And people notice something is different. Usually the patient themselves doesn't notice that something's different because their brain is having trouble and they're sick. So when people say, gee, mom is more forgetful today than ever, and you say, well, what changed? Well, she seems to be spending a lot of time in the bathroom. Okay, well, let's go to the doctor's office and get checked for a urinary tract infection. Or mom is angry or depressed or not paying a lot of attention to what we're doing now, and she was fine last week. Well, what happened last week? Well, the doctor changed her medicine. Okay. If something has changed, then you need to bring that to somebody else's attention. Meaning, when you started having more headaches and we could pinpoint there was a fall, you go to the doctor and say, huh, I fell and here are the consequences. Or mom's medicine changed and now she's acting this way. Look for delirium. And what we say is you don't have to wait for it to be a crisis. So in your case, you already had the issue because of the fall. It's a good thing somebody else said something to you and helped you connect the dots, because you probably weren't able to yourself. And so
no.
we say it's not always being nosy. Sometimes it's being caring.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I mean, it's good to mention it. If the person doesn't bite, they don't, you know, they don't bite. But on the other hand, you could be doing them a great favor. You know, that made me go get looked at, and at least they did a scan and I wasn't having another brain bleed, you know, so
right. Right.
That was nice to know.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And I'm glad that they were paying attention to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, the first time they weren't, they misdiagnosed the brain aneurysm and for over 24 hours, because I went to the emergency room and they did not do a scan, said I was having a muscle spasm in my neck, wrote out a prescription for pain pills and sent me home. And it
oh, wow.
struck me, just a sidebar for a moment. again, the audience has heard this, but I thought of the miracle. The first thing when you first started talking, I thought, I see the miracles in your story too, because you had been working with the doctors. You said they treated you like a peer. You knew some of the things that you knew, and how miraculous that was, and having access to the best doctors and so forth, like you were saying. And in my case, I was fortunate in a miraculous divine intervention kind of way in a couple different places. And, you know, one of them is that I worked during the day. I was in sales, so I was always out and about driving my car, and I was never with family members, but my dad had asked me if I wanted to. It came up in a conversation. I had an appointment downtown just to get a paper signed from a client, and he said, how about if I drive you down and we have a cappuccino after, if the rest of your afternoon is free? And so I said, okay. And for that reason, he was driving, not me, because after I got that paper signed, got in the car, we had driven a block, and my brain exploded. And immediately I recoiled, you know, brought my arms and legs in. And if I would have been driving, I wouldn't have been in control of the car. And, you know, the next thing is that when I yelped, he said, what's wrong? I said, I need to go to a hospital. And when we got there, and that diagnosis was given, I had a home of my own and was single, and my dad said, you know, why don't you come to our place until that medication kicks in, and then we'll take you home just to make sure you're all right. Now, if it would have been a friend that dropped me off at home, I would have died. But because I was there, you know, when I started vomiting violently and then they even called the doctor, and he said that I was having, that the medication was too strong to give me less next time. He still wasn't picking up on it. So I went, not 24 hours, but 15, you know, whatever. Well, no, it probably was 24 hours from the time that it hit. But by the next day, I couldn't talk anymore. And within an hour of that, I couldn't comprehend anymore. And they just quit calling the doctor and took me back to the hospital. And, you know, I was within all of that was a rapid downhill, in a coma for the next 11 days, and had brain surgery, you know, while I was out. And when I woke up, had no idea what happened, you know, whether I was on foot or horseback. But the other miracle in that was that the doctor, there was a visiting neurosurgeon in town, and he had worked with, I'm trying to think of the Swiss doctor. Microneurosurgical techniques were newer in 1995. And Yasser Jill, I think his name was, he actually was one of the pioneers of microneurosurgical techniques, and also made some of the tiny tools to be able to do that kind of surgery. And like the clip that's in my head is one that he designed. Anyway, this visiting neurosurgeon had studied with him, and he happened to be in our town teaching other doctors how to do the procedure that I wound up having. And I was like that neurosurgeon's dream case, you know. He played to a full surgical suite, you know, everybody watching. I teased him later about not having been in my right mind to sign a model release that they should be paying me for.
Exactly.
That, you know, that tape they made of that procedure that they did. But, you know, I mean, all of those were such, again, a long sidebar, I guess, but just the miracles that happen in the midst of all these horrible things that go on. And I heard it at the beginning of your story, and have heard them from people in the audience and other guests, where, you know, right when it was going down a certain path, a curveball of divine intervention goes in there, and we probably wouldn't have made it. Now, in your case, you're like the third person in a row that I've heard that has had a stroke after having heart surgery. Is that, am I just happening to hear of a cluster of those now, or is that fairly common?
I think it's not common, but it's also not completely unexpected. It does change the treatment of stroke, because obviously they can't give you a clot-busting drug that's going to make you bleed out from surgery. But,
right,
you know, if you're going to have a stroke, you might as well have it in one of the best hospitals around. And
actually
raises a very good point, which is when you think you're having a stroke or an aneurysm, particularly now, you know, in this time frame, calling 911 is the most important thing to do. And usually the EMTs take you to the closest hospital, but in case of stroke, very often they can take you to a specialized stroke center, even if it's a little further away. So if you are conscious,
yeah,
somebody is there
a
for
level
you,
one trauma.
Yep.
Sorry.
You call 911 and you say the word stroke.
Mm-hmm.
So that you make sure you're at some place that can handle it for you. And you use the word stroke,
right,
even if you mean aneurysm or something else, because use the simple words that they'll understand.
Oh, okay. So they would take you to a level one trauma type hospital?
If it's available. Yep, if it's available. If there's a choice, that's where they will take you. And the other thing is, when you're looking at brain stuff, the brain is in the body. And it sounds obvious, but, you know, you have to take care of your cardiovascular system, and you have to understand the symptoms. So, for example, there's a lot of science out now, and Women's Heart Health Month, I believe, is July. And one of the issues is, particularly in women, they don't know they're having a heart attack. They don't know if they're in congestive heart failure, and they don't know if they could be having a heart attack, even if they're not in the throes of the middle of it. So people think of heart attacks as, well, it's crushing chest pain and my left arm hurts. That's what happens in men.
Right.
Women can have something like back pain or jaw pain. And strokes and aneurysms, people say, oh, well, I can still stick my tongue out, so I must be okay. The answer is, when in doubt for something like that, call 911, because you need to let trained medical professionals make medical judgments. And I will tell you, any of my friends and colleagues who just heard me utter those words are laughing hysterically and saying, oh, look, Jody finally learned her lesson. Because I would say, well, okay, I'll just take myself to the hospital. My famous quote from that one of my friends heard was, ambulances are for sick people. And they're like, yeah, if you think you could be having a heart attack, or you think you could be having a stroke, or you think you could be having an asthma attack, or you think you could be having an aneurysm, call 911. They'd rather be disturbed than pick you up off the side of the road.
Right.
So that's my little editorial comment. I did learn my lesson.
How did you, well, I was going to say, and that this is just, I'll make it much shorter. This is another sidebar, is that the reason I was misdiagnosed, as far as I'm concerned, and I don't know about with the stroke, I've heard about the tongue, but, you know, it was, did I know my name and shine the flashlight in my eye and had me squeeze his fingers? Well, on that, he based, you know, that I was having a muscle spasm in my neck and it wasn't serious. Well, I think if you're pretty sure it is, if you're one of the survivors out here, you've been through a TBI, or even if you're just positive, because there is, like I knew there was something really seriously wrong with me when that happened.
Yes.
And if you're feeling that way about it, push them hard for a scan, whether they want it or not,
yes,
whether they want to do it or not, because, that test, an hour later, I wouldn't have passed that test, just because I could that moment. An hour later, I couldn't even have come close. And by the next day, what test? I wasn't even present anymore, and almost wasn't present at all anymore. So push them for that scan. Say, that you're a prior brain trauma survivor, that you've been through this before and you need a scan, that the tests otherwise, and until they improve them or they catch you at just the right time, aren't adequate. Now, I want to go back to the heart for a moment, because I too have heard, I think maybe most of us have heard now, that the women's symptoms aren't the same as a man's symptoms. So a lot of times a woman having a heart attack, and you just said, a woman might not know if she's in the middle of a heart attack or congestive heart failure or any of those things. How did you know that you were having a heart incident? I mean, if we're saying that it doesn't necessarily present as a gripping pain to the heart with a really painful left arm, then how would we know?
Well, that is a very good question. So I actually did not have a heart attack. I was in the emergency room for an asthma attack, and there was a great doctor whose gut instinct bothered him. And so he just, everything came back sort of funky, and this guy was not letting me go. So I was lucky because I was in the right hospital with somebody who said, this is still not right, even if she's not having a heart attack. But one of the things that women need to know about, I'll give you the symptoms, and because it's different for women. So number one, shortness of breath, easily misdiagnosed as asthma or attributed to asthma or I worked out too hard or whatever. So shortness of breath is number one. And very often it can even be shortness of breath, not on exertion, but like just sitting there and you're just not right. Then there are a couple other things. There can be jaw pain. There can be back pain or stomach pain. And so you would need to look for those things. Sweating, heavy perspiration. And I am assuming that many members of the audience are of a certain age, myself included. It is really easy to write it off as a hot flash. Don't assume it's a hot flash.
Yeah. Huh.
Sometimes people say it's like flu-like symptoms, like they're just exhausted. They just don't really feel right. And basically, what most of the science says now is if you are experiencing something that doesn't feel exactly right, you call 911 and you don't let them discount you. So the biggest thing is don't minimize it. Okay, I'm a little hot and sweaty. I don't know. I'm just tired. I just don't feel right. You need to say words that trigger. You need to basically get away from the bias against older women, okay? And so you say, I'm afraid I'm having a heart attack. I think I might be having a stroke. Sometimes, for example, a woman could have something that looks like sleep apnea, you know, waking up in the middle of the night, you can't catch your breath. And sometimes it's sleep apnea, and sometimes it's a sign of a heart attack. So basically, the reality is you have got to look at what you're feeling, recognize something's different, and trust your own body. And do not hesitate to call 911. But make sure you use words and don't minimize your symptoms. Now, if a man calls up and has trouble breathing, they say, oh, he might be having a heart attack. So you really need to just be very, very clear and not be – they used to say for stroke, they used to either use the word FAST, an acronym. Now for stroke, what they're saying is if you've got numbness or weakness on one side, your confusion, you have difficulty seeing or walking, or you have a sudden severe headache, call 911 and say stroke. With a heart attack, sometimes if it's a heart attack, sometimes it's not very subtle. But if it's an impending heart attack or something else, you're going to have symptoms like sweating and your jaw hurts. And they're going to say you should go to the dentist and you're probably menopausal.
Right.
And so the reality is assume that they're going to write you off for whatever reason. The better hospitals and the better doctors know to look for different symptoms, but there's still a lot of traditionalists, if you will, who say, oh, there, she's probably just stressed and give her a Valium.
Right.
So you have to be a real advocate for yourself. And I keep saying you don't have to practice medicine without a license. But if you are not feeling well, you have somebody with a really big mouth, I say you find your most obnoxious friend, and that's the one you want speaking on your behalf.
Yes.
Because otherwise they're going to send you with a painkiller.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I want to get back to your book. Again, anybody who came in a little late, we took some detours, but this has been fascinating and I think eye-opening for everybody listening. That's why I like doing interviews this way, because you just never know how things are going to come up. But Jody Lyons is with me tonight, and she's an elder care expert. Check out her website at brainhealthasyouage.com. And I'll put that in the chat room again, brainhealthasyouage.com. And we started talking, Brain Health as You Age, a practical guide to maintenance and prevention. Is when you were talking about maintenance and prevention, healthy lifestyle, I assume, exercise, diet, those things, are those some of the things that you can do to help mitigate the aging process?
So you've asked a perfect question, and it's, so what can you do about it? Is there anything you can do about it, and what can you do about it? And so the answer is there are indeed ways to mitigate your risks. And earlier in the show, I had mentioned the website enrichvisits.com. And the acronym ENRICH, E-N-R-I-C-H, is something that Dr. Bill Mansfield had come up with. And so I will break down the ENRICH, which is the healthy habits. So number one is E, in exercise daily, meaning physical aerobic activity. And what does that mean? Because I have said to Dr. Mansbach, you are not making me get up at 5:30 in the morning and become a gym rat. So exercise daily means physical aerobic activity. And the way he explains it is if you can carry on a conversation like you and I are doing now, you're not exercising hard enough. But if you can't carry on the conversation other than to gasp, get me off the treadmill, then you're exercising too hard. So exercise daily with aerobic activity. And again, make sure you've checked with your doctor before you just start an exercise program. The end in Enrich is no smoking. And to everybody out there who's smoking and says, I've been smoking for 50 years, it is never too late to stop. Your brain will indeed change as soon as you stop and your body stops. It recognizes that you stopped smoking. Okay. The R is routinely add cognitive stimulation that is challenging and progressive. Now, this is a hard one. There's a lot of stuff out on the market that says it's going to improve your brain, and basically all it does is lighten your wallet. And we always hear people say, but I do the crossword puzzle. So what we mean by routinely adding cognitive stimulation is scientifically validated tools. You can see Dr. Mansbach's research is wonderful. You can see that on the Enrich Visits website, or if you go to his other website, thebcat.com, you can see his research, and it's really pretty cool. So you have to add cognitive stimulation that's challenging. So if you always do the crossword puzzle and you always finish it and it's always easy, that's not going to be continually and progressively stimulating. Right.
Right.
So you need to come up with the appropriate parts of exercise. You want to appropriately exercise the parts of your brain you need to. And again, his screening tools will tell you what you need. Now, the I in Enrich is improve mood. This one I cannot stress enough. Fighting and treating depression. A lot of people suffer from an undiagnosed, untreated, low-grade depression. And that actually is a risk factor for dementia. So you really need to identify it, speak about it, go to a doctor and get treated. And again, this is one of those things about don't let the doctor write you off as you're just a little sad or that's normal, her kids went off to college or whatever. If you really are depressed, you need to be screened for it. And the only way to know if you're really depressed is to be screened for it. And it needs to be dealt with. The C for Enrich is control hypertension and the heart rate. So what does that mean? That means to actually comply with the medications that your cardiologist says and make sure that your blood pressure is within range. And then the H for Enrich is healthy weight and body fat. This does not under any circumstances go back to the, you know, not becoming a gym rat. Healthy weight and body fat means focus on healthy. This does not mean skinny. This does not mean you need to be a model, but what is healthy for you? And you need to determine that in concert with your own physician. And so we use the acronym Enrich, and there are 6 healthy habits. There are certainly a lot more, but Enrich seemed to be the number that people could actually do and still have a life. Because the other thing is, one of the really important parts of protecting your brain, in addition to Enrich, which is, you know, mitigating your risk factors, is to have a good social support network. The newer studies are starting to show that people who are lonely are more likely to have a cognitive impairment, and that not having a social support system is a big risk factor. So you certainly want to be able to have the Enrich healthy lifestyle habits, but also not have them become your only reason for being, and then you don't have a social life as well. So you are supposed to go out and have a cup of coffee with a friend. And so that's basically Enrich in a nutshell. And we have information about that on both of our websites, on the brainhealthasyouage.com and on the enrichvisits.com. And if you want the science behind it, it's on thebcat.com.
Okay, there is a the in front of that. It does.
Yes, the BCAT. Yep. The
okay, I'm.
Blues. Yep, you got it?
Got it. Yep. Yep. Tell people is just a second, bcat.com.
Sure.
I typed it into the chat room and now I wrote it in my own note because what I do, I do take notes as I go. So for those of you who don't catch these or don't happen to be in the chat room and you're wanting to know what it was she said without going back and listening to the entire show, which I ought to just have you do that. But you can always, a lot of you out there know how to get a hold of me through social media, and I do take down these websites. Now, the main website I gave in the beginning, brainhealthasyouage.com, because I wasn't really – in the does it refer to these other sites too or no?
It does, and it also
that's what
has,
I thought.
It also has a link to our YouTube channel. Dr. Simmons and Dr. Mansbach and I had done a television show called Your Need to Know, and it's in Fairfax County, but then they've rebroadcast on YouTube. And it's on a lot of public access stations as well. So if you do want more information, we have the TV shows and the links to the YouTube channel where the shows are now stored is on the Brain Health As You Age as well. And then there's a link to the Enrich Visits website as well.
That's what I thought. There's usually what I call the mothership website that will direct you to everywhere else. So in that case, I do have these others, but in the program notes, which you can find at braininjuryradio.com or at myinaflash.org or any of the 60 places I posted today, in those program notes, at the very bottom of that first paragraph is the website brainhealthasyouage.com. So if you go there, that will direct you to all of the rest of the websites that we've talked about tonight and the YouTube channel. And I encourage you to watch those. I had forgotten, but when we first talked, which was quite a while ago, I watched one of those and it left my mind because we had a holiday and a few shows in between, and that happens to me. But I'm glad you mentioned that again because I wanted to go back after I had watched the first one of them. Very enlightening and a lot of really powerful information. And as I said at the beginning, all of us are, again, except for a reason for a premature exit, we're all aging, you know, every day we're aging, we're moving closer, and there's natural effects of aging, and we should be aware of what is natural. And then because this is Brain Injury Radio, and, you know, face it, the majority of the demographic here, including all of our hosts, are either some kind of brain trauma survivor. We have a stroke, a couple aneurysms, several TBIs, and,
mm-hmm.
and most all are multiples, you know, most all. In the time that since I've started, it's really interesting because there's probably 5 or 6 of our 20 hosts that, and myself is one of them in the 7.5 years I've been here, and we've gotten new hosts along the way that have had subsequent brain injuries of some kind, like I did. It might not have been what we would have considered the big one, you know, that first mm-hmm. one that we had. Some people have a horrible, horrible car accident, and, you know, whatever it might be. But we have a little bit of everything, and that's why it's Brain Injury Radio. And, you know, for us, again, those of you who might have come in late, another one of the reasons I thought Jody would be a great guest to have on, a lot of reasons, but we're already experiencing some challenges. And so if we can find ways to help us, already knowing that we might be starting a pole position behind on this aging process and our brain shrinking or whatever it does as we're getting older. You want to make sure you hydrate, but also get skills, just like we had to get skills or rethink some of our old thinking and be open-minded and willing to take some new actions and have some new awarenesses about the direction that we were going after we had our initial brain injury. That same thing replays, and we've got the skill set to do it because we already did it once. We just don't have the tools and maybe haven't thought about it, but it's inevitable. And not only for us, but a lot of us have parents that are aging, loved ones that are aging. And so we all experience this, and those of us with brain injury might be even a little more challenging. So, again, I think that the resources at Jody's site, brainhealthasyouage.com, and checking out the book. Oh, that's it's that reading glasses thing. They are on the top of my head. Brain Health as You Age, a Practical Guide to Maintenance and Prevention. Now, that definitely worth the read, because we need all the help that we can get in this community as we're aging, and that book will provide that. In fact, you even on Amazon, it lets you open it up and get a sneak peek at the table of contents and see, you know, what's in there. And it's an easy read. But the one that I started to read, I do just want to say this, you'd probably see it on the site, and I read it in the opening. It's in the program notes, but The Smart Person's Guide to Elder Care. Now, whether you're reading that knowing that you're going to be an elder someday and you might be able to do some of the things, and Jody talked about them earlier, and there are others, but getting certain things squared away before it's a crisis situation and emotions are more involved, or there's time, you know, that like it's got to be done now kind of a thing. We all know that the best decisions aren't always made under those circumstances. So whether you have parents that are aging or you yourself are aging and you want to be able to communicate your wants and needs and desires to your loved ones, then I think that's a great book to read as well. You know, in both we get tools, but in that one, you know, that's a really good way for us to plan, you know, and there's a couple things I've said to people that, our loved ones that, you know, they haven't appreciated always some suggestions that I've made that I think would make it easier, because, you know, and maybe it's just some people, and maybe it's more people as we age that don't like the idea of change, especially that direction of change, you know, as we're in our sunset time. You know, they don't like it. They don't want to change. They're resistant to it. They resent the hell out of you for bringing it up. And will even go the other way 100 miles an hour faster if you bring it up. Now, I used to get angry about that. And now, you know, I say, and this is what I would say about these books, and I don't have stock in her book company. I'm just being honest. If you want your choice to matter, then to do a preemptive strike and to have these things in place before they're needed ensures that you're going to have more of your choices and your needs met the way you would want them to be, and that someone else isn't making the choice for you, or that you have, you know, let's say that you have a dozen choices right now, but if just a certain thing happened, it could be in the next 10 minutes, something that would happen that would take those choices away from you or take it down to one choice. Then you would wish, you know, that it wouldn't have been a resentment or a denial or just not liking change, that it's a good thing to keep your options open and to know the questions. You know, one of the things when a lot of us had our initial brain traumas is we didn't know what was going on and we didn't even know the questions to ask. What I'm trying to do here tonight by having Jody is that we do know we're going to age. We do know personally inside our heart of hearts, each one of us individually, what compromises or changes, challenges we already have to deal with, and can maybe guess a little bit what direction that might go. And so anyway, both of the books give you an idea of what questions you need to be asking and what actions you need to be taking to ensure the choice. You know, that
yes.
you
yeah,
are
thank
able
you
to
for
make
saying that.
The choice.
I really appreciate your saying that, because that was one of the reasons that I wrote both of the books. And, you know, certainly Dr. Simmons and Dr. Mansbach on the second book on brain health as you age, one of the things that was so important to us is to make sure that people know what questions to ask and have some mm-hmm. control over their lives. So, for example, you know, we talked about the brain healthy habits of Enrich. Well, we do talk about myth versus reality, and are there diets that might help or are there diets that aren't, with really good validated science behind it. But then one of the other things we talk about are managing expectations. What are realistic expectations of the person who becomes the patient, and of their caregivers, and of family, and how do you make sure your needs are protected and your desires are protected so that you don't have whatever you don't want to have happen to you. So when you look at a stroke or an aneurysm or a heart attack or a car accident or falling off a horse or something like that, one minute your life is normal, and the next minute everything is changed, as you said. Well, what do you want to have happen? What's okay and what's not okay? Do you want to continue living where you're living, and is it safe to do so? And, you know, it's not always easy. And what I always say is you have every right to be safe. You have every right to be under control for your pain. You have every right to be clean and comfortable. And you have every right for good medical care, period, non-negotiable. But how do you ensure that those things are provided? Well, maybe your home setting has to change. Maybe the home you are living in isn't safe. Maybe your financial resources aren't enough to help you survive what you think you want. Dr. Simmons and I recently spoke at a conference in Las Vegas to a bunch of financial advisors. And when we were talking about how does your financial plan change in the context of dementia, it was surprising. I think a lot of financial advisors were surprised at how high the cost of care can be. So when we were talking about people with behaviors or frontal lobe dementia, that's not $4,500 a month in most parts of the country. So how do you plan for it? And if you can't afford it, what are your other options? You know, and then the hardest part is, what can you expect from your family and friends, and what can you not expect? And how do you recognize when you need to jettison some of those people from your life and bring other people in? You need to think about that now. We all have that friend who's a total flake, and like if you say, can you go get me a prescription, has never been able to get from point A to point B without stopping and, you know, finding something else to do and then showing up the pharmacy 2 hours after it closes. That is not the person you want to rely on to be getting your medications for you.
Right.
So you really need to know what to expect, what to ask, and who to ask for the help from. Build your team.
Yes. Well, yes, and that's the other thing is why I did what I did and want to read both of these books is because, again, like with our initial brain injury, that was the first time we had that. We didn't, you know, again, we didn't know what questions to ask, but we didn't know what resources were available. And the same thing with this aging out, you know, and doing it before there's a crisis. And so I'm anxious to have that information and be able to put some of the things you mentioned earlier I have done, but nobody would be able to find them. So, you know, communicating that would be a good thing. I mean, a will and a living will and some of those things can't be honored if nobody knows where they are, you know, so you've got to trust somebody enough to know where those things are. And again, anyway, I recommend, we've got about 8 minutes left and so we're winding down, but anyway, if you hadn't guessed, I highly recommend, and maybe it's just because I had one of those landmark birthdays and it's more on my mind now, but you know, if you're out there and you're 30, you might not be worried about it, but you know, you too, with, you know, with luck and grace, are going to be living to a ripe old age. And if you have parents or grandparents that you care about, you know, and maybe you don't want to be hands-on involved, but you also want to make sure that they don't really mess things up, and you have their back somewhat, then, you know, even younger people, it's good to know these things ahead of time. You know, again, I've seen a lot of situations where people are dealing out of heightened emotion at a time, you know, when it's not good to be making heavy duty decisions, and they, you know, the decisions are made, poor decisions are made under pressure and with peak emotion and under a time constraint where you've got to decide in the next week, you know, and now, you know, if you're reading these resources and you kind of know what to expect, what you need to be doing, then I don't mean to put a sense of panic in you out there, but we all also know that when we got up that day, we didn't expect to have our life turned upside down by our injury. So while I'm not trying to create a sense of urgency, I'm trying to create a sense of importance. You know, it's important that we know this time that we go in with our eyes open and armed with the facts that we need before we're vulnerable or caught off guard and don't have those resources. So That's something you can do right now that would be one of those advanced thought exercises that a lot of you probably haven't done out there.
Right, but you can change it as your situation changes, but it's nice to know what you can expect, what you can't expect. And, you know, I always say it's kind of like the boogeyman in a five-year-old's bedroom. To them, that boogeyman is real. And until you open up the closet door, turn on the lights, and identify what the boogeyman really is, it's going to continue to be terrifying. And so what we're trying to do is literally shed light on the subject. And I do mean it literally.
Yes.
Bring it out into the daylight and look at it and read it. It's on paper, and we have discussed all of the hard things to discuss in the book, including sex and aging. I mean, we've covered everything from brains to sex to finances and to what you need to talk to your lawyer about. So it's out in the open, and you can read it. And then from that point, you can assemble your team and take action as you see fit. And to your earlier point, people are always worried about the will. And I always say, well, that's about stuff. What about you?
Yeah.
And are you equally as important to your family and friends as the set of dishes that you're trying to make sure they leave?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Jody, thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate you spending your time with us tonight. And I'll be looking forward to reading your books. And I hope we can stay in touch and you'll come back again sometime.
I really appreciate it, Kim. Thank you very, very much. And we do have a contact information form on the Brain Health As You Age website if people have more information. And the other thing is, if you have more questions about the deep science behind it in our book, we actually do have a whole bibliography for people who would like to read the original source material as well.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to thank you, Jody. Thank you so much. Okay, everybody, I will be back next Wednesday night. Check out the program notes for those websites again. I want to thank Jody Lyons for being my guest tonight. Can't remember who's next week, but I'll be here next week, and you'll just have to show up to see. I'm going to close with Daniel Christian. You can find him at danielchristianmusic.com. And this is kind of what we were talking about tonight, but what we're always processing about, this is Find My Voice. Thanks so much, everybody. Good night and God bless.
The question never seems to change. Are you with them or are you with us? And if it's true, I am not ashamed. There shouldn't be much to discuss. But for every answer that draws you near, there is an answer that will make you run. As long as identity remains unclear, the coward will give the easy one. We can be automatic, carefully diplomatic. I need courage to speak my choice. Now that it's been a while since my courtyard denial, I am still trying to find my voice. I am still trying to find my voice. My brother is waiting to believe. We all love him just the same. There are gifts we both receive under the same sun and rain. I can't speak up. out of stillness, but I'm waiting to fill this space with courage to make my choice. How can we preach salvation from our own isolation? I am trying to find my voice. I am just trying to find my voice. Never knew I would come this far. When you get too good at fitting in, it's hard to tell who you really are.